Kia ora, welcome to episode 31 of The Good Oil, Conversations with Aotearoa Painters. In this episode, I visit Andrew McLeod at his home and studio in Whanganui. Andrew holds a Bachelor of Fine Arts from the Elam School of Fine Arts at the University of Auckland. He is now over 27 years into his practice, and his work is held in numerous public and private collections, including the Fletcher Collection, the Auckland Art Gallery Toi O Tamaki Collection, the Chartwell Collection in the National Gallery of Victoria, the Museum of New Zealand Te Papa Tongarewa, and the Arts House Trust. He has been a recipient of several art prizes and residencies, including the Tiley Cottage Residency in Whanganui. Andrew is represented by Robert Hild Gallery in Wellington, Te Whanganui Atara, and Ivan Anthony Gallery in Tamaki Makaurau, Auckland. There are images of the paintings that we talk about on the Good Oil Andrew McLeod Instagram post for your reference. This episode turns out to be, for me at least, and I hope you, an excellent lesson in art history and how to look at paintings, both of which are actually Andrew talking about his practice. You'll see what I mean. Although you'll also hear him talk about being Gen X and as a result what he's not afraid of in painting, a want for his next painting to always be his best, how he views paintings as an arrangement of attention and a kind of frozen choreography of brushstrokes, and how a key aspect of his job is to work in the visual subconscious world we all populate. Please note, if you're listening with children or a priest present, Andrew's enthusiasm in the interview leads to some occasional colourful language. We started by talking about Andrew's early memories of experiencing art.
We didn't really have art. I don't come from a background where there would be paintings on the walls. So I'm sort of lower middle class. My father's a builder. Mum's a nurse. So in terms of kind of art in an art gallery or a museum, it would probably be school, primary school and stuff. So I saw Te Māori in Auckland from... I guess primary school. I saw the version of Te Māori in Auckland, which was pretty fucking amazing.
Yeah.
So that's definitely a big one. There was a show, I think when I was a bit older, maybe like 11, a big Picasso show in Auckland in the 80s. And it was quite a big show.
So as an 11-year-old, you were like, what the hell are these things?
Yeah. I mean, I was already kind of like inclined to drawing and stuff as a kid because I was better at that stuff. I'm better at drawing than reading and writing. And maths. And so, yeah.
Well, what about that transition to deciding that you wanted to pursue a more formal practice, so pursue formal training? That's a bit of a leap there, I guess, from being 11 and looking at Picasso works, etc. But what was that step into formal training at Elam?
Well, it's a high school, the high school. So it's the New Zealand education system.
So, and a good art teacher at high school.
Yeah, definitely. Good luck with that. I had good luck. So it was kind of age 13, 14, I was still interested in the whole of drawing. So it'd be everything, you know, comics, illustration, animation, interested in everything. When I was about 15, I sort of got more into, just fell more in love with the painting kind of form, tradition, more specifically.
So thought taking it into university would be a pretty good idea.
Mainly I just fell in love with the art form. I mean, it's the first thing, is really getting into it as a fan. First, you know.
Well, it sounds like it was quite a while before you like started applying any paint per se. So lots of drawing, but not necessarily painting for a while.
Yeah, there's a bit of paint. There's kind of, schools have acrylic and tempera. Was in the school system, and going back to kindergarten, you know, there's tempera. is a fantastic powdery, opaque type of paint, water-based paint. I think actually, some of my earliest memories are actually painting outdoors at play school in Auckland.
Really?
So I think my earliest memory is painting flowers on a fence with my mother. In Auckland. I started.
Started pretty early.
So it's like the big scale and the brush. And the subject matter started, could say.
I think most people recognise you as a painter, which is where practice has been dedicated for, I don't know, certainly the last probably decade or two. But you're multidisciplinary as well. So there's been textiles, jewellery, have been, still are, musician, printmaker's been part of the practice. So have they all informed the painting?
Yeah, I think the truth is that it's always been painting. And I've always just done them in terms of time and effort, and the kind of the truth of the tradition that the work is from is just real painting. So everything else is kind of like when I did jewellery, it was a side project of a painter and stuff. So it's always painting was always the centre in terms of time and effort.
So it always has been for you. Painting's always been the primary.
Yeah, it was right from high school. I just loved painting. The things that painting can kind of specifically do, as opposed to even illustration and comics, you know, and drawing, yeah.
Because it did seem like you could take the practice just about anywhere. Like, it seems like there's a really strong sense, at least historically, those works that I was talking about before, so interior with pink, untinted with rainbow, but both of those seem to have a strong graphic design element too. You have a strong sense of graphic design sensibility, maybe.
Yeah, well, the interesting thing about that is that I think, because of my sort of where I sit art historically, I'm about 50, a sort of younger Gen X.
Mm.
It's kind of a bit distinct even from older Gen X. So I'm not afraid of a whole bunch of things they were afraid of and the boomers were afraid of. So it's like, I'm not afraid of a can. I'm not afraid of so-called decorative. And also I'm a North Islander. So the whole South Island kind of thing, it just doesn't make sense to me. I couldn't do it. Yeah, I'm just being true to my background, really.
Does that mean you're not afraid of applied arts either? Because there's been, I suppose, some applied arts in textiles.
Yeah. It's kind of like... The point is to find something really good, not to find something that's fits into your sort of genre or idiom or is expensive or classy. It's just you just want to find something really good to be inspired by and to learn about the art form, which is visual culture, at a wider.
Mm.
I mean, they say with the generational thing that I'm sort of... young Gen X is a bit more collage and stuff, you know, so you get, like, old Gen X invents the early hip-hop and then young Gen X sort of does more sort of collage and expands it sonically, and so it's sort of somewhat complementary, and I think that's kind of true of me compared to Shane Cotton or something.
Well, that's probably a...
And everyone my age. Their age.
It's, I guess, a good point you're making about your own practice, which is, you know, you've developed over... 3 decades, a really broad range of capability, that's pretty much an understatement, that's moved really freely between abstract and figurative work, and quite often they seem to work together really well. So are you quite cognizant of the ability for you to be able to work with them, and especially combining abstraction and figurative work into a sum, you know, that's greater than their parts, maybe?
Yeah. I mean, the whole Greenbergian doctrine is still around. The abstraction is pure and classy. But I just couldn't take that seriously. I mean, and the fact is that abstraction, I mean, they did it in the 70s with the pattern and decoration movement in painting, which no one remembers, which is mostly pretty bad. But abstraction comes from textiles. It comes from pattern. I mean, it's not... At a human level, I mean, painting as an art form is brushwork. The choreography of brushwork, it's amazing. It's frozen movement. So half of the art form is the brushwork and layering and the way they interact. So you always have to go up close to a painting, always, to see what's going on, feel what's going on. It's frozen choreography, you know, it's the thing I say. So, and that interacts with composition, which happens in any painting, abstract or figurative. And then you have subject matter, more or less. And you're meant to play a game. It's kind of like with subject matter. So, I don't know, Chardin will do a painting of a fish on a table, on a plate, and it's not about, the painting's not about fish or plates, you know, and that's obvious. And it's the same with abstract. So then, it's all just continuous thing. Abstraction is nothing new.
Well, I know I'm making this, I do this but, in these conversations, I end up talking about, you know, this almost a hard definition of what is figurative, what is abstract.
Yeah.
But
I mean, you do know when you see it.
Yeah.
Everyone knows when they see it.
But I find it interesting with your work especially that, so for listener reference, but maybe for you as well, Andrew, a work called From the Inner Light from 2009, and we'll include an image of this on the Andrew McLeod Good Oil Instagram post for listener reference. There's an element there where you're employing what seems to be abstract composition. So despite the fact that all the elements in the work are quite figurative. So is that another way that you've played or employed abstraction?
Yeah. I mean, the legacy is, you look at older painters immediately before you and older, and you like a lot of it and you don't like a lot of it. You're speaking to them. It's kind of like a conversation in a way down the generations, everyone, you know. You're responding in a way that is authentic to you. It's that authenticity thing to your time and psyche and where you come from. So the correct response when you're talking to someone who has a different accent to you is not to mimic their accent, it's to talk in your own accent.
Yeah.
Or else I think you're a fool.
And therefore your own painting.
It's like, that's a good metaphor, isn't it?
Yeah.
Don't copy people's accents.
Yeah. Well, as a bit of a step on from that, there's I tend to do this in these interviews. I throw quotes back at painters. You were writing about your favourite works from Te Whare o Rehua, the Sargent Gallery here in Whanganui. And for listener reference, I'm visiting Andrew in his studio. And you'd said, talking about Edward Burne Jones's work,
all right,
that the trick all artists need to work out is how to turn limitations as well as their weaknesses into strengths.
Yeah.
So that begs the question, what weaknesses or limitations of your own are you working to that you're turning into strengths?
Oh, yeah. I think that's got to be pretty intuitive in a whole, you know, it takes a whole person to work that stuff out. I mean, one of the classic examples of that is Andy Warhol coming straight after the Abstract Expressionists. Andy Warhol couldn't be an Abstract Expressionist in terms of his forward-facing, like, marketability. I mean, his personality was just all wrong. He had no hope of fitting into that world, and he knew it. He's probably very well aware because of a rejection by his whole time and place in America, you know, in the fucking 50s and stuff. So he's a great example. The whole Andy Warhol thing, he's a fantastic artist, was just all weaknesses into strengths, right? And, you know, it's fucking funny.
Well, but what are yours? So,
well, yeah, I think it's kind of like asking...
Is it hard to be cognizant of him?
Yeah, but it's like asking Andy Warhol, how are you funny?
Right.
It's just like, well, the best answer is just is another joke or, you know, an insult or a...
So it sounds like your answer to that is, I don't know, I've worked through them.
Other people who really love painting will see all that stuff in the work. It's just part of the stuff that you take on board when you appreciate someone's work. Yeah, I mean, you see that in everyone.
Mm. So
artist has weaknesses, and it's appreciation is knowing that every work is just an attempt, but still there's a vast difference in quality in work. Well, I mean, the limitations is my background as well. I mean, I live in New Zealand. I didn't get to grow up looking at the great paintings. Mm. I mean, that's a big limitation, isn't it? And that's not Yeah, that's to everyone who grew up in New Zealand.
Well, we were talking before we started recording.
Yeah,
we were chatting, and you had said that you'd basically said that your latest work is going to inevitably be your best. So do you feel like you're working through those weaknesses, limitations? Maybe they're not the right words, but every work you feel like you're evolving, and the work's getting better all the time.
Yeah. I think also. Also, I've made a judgment about the trajectory of my sort of study and learning about painting is kind of a really slow, long kind of way I've gone about it. I have made a lot of terrible work. I shouldn't say. My dealers probably won't want me to say that, but yeah.
Well, maybe the way to phrase that is the work keeps getting better.
Made weaker work and better work, and everyone does, even the greats. I mean, there's a way to approach... So, in a way, when you have less limitations on your influences and stuff that you look at, then it takes longer to absorb it all and then make your response to it. And it's kind of a difference between, like, an amateur or hobbyist and someone that's going to devote their life to it. So, I'm lucky I knew I was going to devote my life to it and kind of... through life bad luck, I've had been able to spend more time, you know, like terrible health problems, physical and mental maybe, you know, it's all kept me in the studio basically, which is kind of terrible luck in life, but good luck in painting. I've had hobbies and stuff, music and stuff, and I've done podcasting and interviews. Yeah. We've both done podcasts. So, I mean, you'd think I'd be a better talker, but, I mean, I was a terrible musician, probably not a very good interviewer, and I can't write.
So plating your strengths, painting.
Yeah, but when I was doing music, I knew to limit it, extremely limited horizons about what I was trying to do. And so that I could achieve something, but it was like it's just a thing people intuit, don't they?
Yeah.
About like, and maybe I was just foolish and ambitious when I was young to go into trying to be a painter in New Zealand. I mean, it's probably a bad idea, but it was just stupidity and love for the medium. And but when I did do hobbies, you know, I knew to be extremely limited and.
And just slowly chip away at the edges of improvement.
There's a long tradition of people from art school doing music, and the way they approach it is different to the people who go to music school. You know, it's really interesting.
By the way, listener reference, if you might be hearing what sounds like painting in the background, Andrew is literally working on work as we chat. So if you hear some scratching noises in the background, that is what that is.
Yeah, I thought it'd be great.
It really is. It's the first time I've had one of these conversations with someone painting as we chat. I'm very impressed. Well, working through that exploration of weaknesses, limitations, however the approach is, it's clear that the painting is just getting better and better.
Oh, that's good, yes. Yeah. I hope so.
Yeah, good news, right? And therefore, like, it also seems seems to just be getting more and more ambitious. So has a guiding principle of the practice always been just a restless curiosity of what painting can offer you and what the outcomes can be?
Yeah, what painting can offer anyone and the audience too, yeah.
Are you quite conscious of painting for an audience as well as yourself?
Yeah, everyone is that makes the arts. It's just some kind of... I mean, there are people. I guess the people that aren't are the outsider artists, you know, like Susan, you know, we were just talking about before, Susan King and people like that. But who knows? I mean, maybe they have more of a reason to communicate in that way. It's communication. I mean, people say, oh, I just do it for myself, but I don't.
You're doing it for an audience.
It's connection. But yeah, everyone does it. You know, it's a kind of contradictory, paradoxical thing. This is the thing I can do in society. This is the best I can do for everyone. So in society, I'm doing my best.
Well, without over-egging this question, then, do you feel like that is your societal contribution? Are these remarkable paintings?
Yeah. I haven't contributed much else. You know, I've got the chronic fatigue syndrome, so I'm pretty hopeless. I can't get a job like my father. you know, I can't be a builder or anything like that. So I have to do a sit-down job, if anything.
Although there's some irony in that, though, right? Chronic fatigue syndrome, but you clearly spend what must be, you know, hundreds of hours on a show. Like, the paintings are ridiculously, incredibly detailed. So it must require, as I say, a show must be hundreds of hours' work.
Yeah, it's a funny contradiction. But, yeah, I mean, you look at some of the great writers, some of the great artists from history, you know, this often, it's not uncommon. Physical, mental issues, right? You know, it's a funny paradoxical thing. I mean, I'm not out tramping or in bands anymore or something, which I used to like to do. I'm painting. But then you get more practice, so you get better.
Yeah.
I mean, I lose brush fluency and literacy after a show when I have a month doing, you know, off. Or
there's some atrophy in talent.
Yeah, man. Yeah, absolutely. A few weeks off and you forget which brush to use and stuff, which is interesting.
We've talked about, like, your range capability of painting, especially the way that it's evolved over the course of the last three decades. But for the last, I think, almost 10 years, you've settled into works that you are literally painting right in front of me as we chat that seem really influenced or inspired by Renaissance and Pre-Raphaelite. So it seems like you've tapped into something that at the moment is a bit of a bottomless well for you in terms of what you can explore and how you can improve your painting.
Yeah, I'm a very influenced by art history type painter, although I think all the best are.
Well, although it's interesting, I guess, that, you know, we talked about Gordon Walters, T.O. Schoon, not looking back too far, but now we're talking about, you know, your influence of Renaissance and Pre-Raphaelite. So you're looking back further into art history with these works.
I guess the bridge between the, Walters and me would be Richard Colleen. They would just talk about, say, you know, it's like Renaissance, they would talk about he liked Bellini. The Bellinis, you know, so it's a certain, it's just composition. Gordon Walters would be in Venice looking at a Bellini in the Frari, and he'd be like, yeah, I'm going to do that. it's just about, this shit goes down the generations. There's no great artist that is not exact connected the same.
Yeah.
Me. And it's just a art history mistake. There's way less iconoclasm in art history than you'll get from the art history department at a university, yeah, you know, yeah, or the books. It's not iconoclasm.
Yeah. Well, they can't.
They're not. They don't. It's, you know.
They can't possibly wrap that up into a tidy 3-year.
People don't get rid of history. They never get rid of history. And modernism, visually modernism, is just, it's Asia, East Asia, you know, it's Art Nouveau. And then it's like Japan and Africa, and you get Cubism, abstract. Minimalism comes from Japan. I mean, modernism is just like this bizarre. It's the world.
It didn't magically appear.
It's the world. Modernism gives you the rest of the world.
Mm.
It doesn't give you Greenberg. That's the visual history. This is the way a painter thinks. This is not the way. There's a big history between the practitioner and the books about the practitioners. There's a big difference. It's a different art history. But we can't articulate it. I mean, listen to me, I'm not very... So we don't write the history, but I know the history from other painters. You know, I look, and I see what influenced them, where they're from. And we don't talk, we don't write. Someone else writes, and they get it wrong in comparison to the practitioners. We have our own history.
Yeah.
And it comes from looking at other people's paintings. But yeah.
These works that you've been working on for the last, as I say, I think almost, you know, 10 years, they're getting more and more extraordinary. The painting looks more and more sophisticated. So I guess the obvious question, is that a reflection of you wanting to push these as far as you can? And it doesn't feel like you're anywhere near pushing them as far as you want to.
No. One lifetime is not enough, which is an interesting, tragic thing about humanity. You know, I mean, I think if the great Bill Hammond had another lifetime, he would have got into oil paint. Mm. But he used acrylic and water beautifully. But, you know, he would have. But, you know, you only get one lifetime. So
is one lifetime
going to miss a lot, but I'm just doing my I don't know. I'm doing my best. I definitely need another 20 years.
So would another 20 years almost not be enough for you to explore these, you know, Renaissance pre-Raphaelite influence works?
No, lifetime is enough.
Does that mean you're left worried at this point about what you're not going to get done?
I'm too busy. I'm just too busy on the latest work. The latest work is too much to concentrate on, so that's good.
Yeah,
that's a good reason to keep busy.
It's a good distraction.
Yeah. If it's not all-consuming, the latest work you're doing, then you're not doing it right, you know. It's just one at a time, and then I'm fucking exhausted. I have idle dreams about future work, but it's really hard work.
Mm.
And it should be.
Well, we're in your studio, and there are two works on the go. So do you tend to work across a couple of different works at once, at least?
Yeah, about two.
And is that about giving you a little bit of a break between each work?
Maybe mostly about, say, drying time.
More practical.
And also the type of work I'm doing. So I'm a very slow painter. I'm way on the slower side of things, but because I've been going a long time and my earlier work was a lot faster, I don't have that reputation. Yeah, if I was a lot faster, I'd have like 10 or 20. And it's just that there's lots of kind of just chance things about the sort of work you start making.
Well, maybe
you like and want to make, and with regard to time and labour, and it's all different. And it doesn't really matter. The main thing is how good the work is. You know, I love some really quick work, like, you know, Cy Twombly or something, and much quicker to make than me. But, you know, the important thing is to make really good work.
Well, I wanted to talk about process a bit in making good work. It seemed like you embraced the capability of digital, what digital could deliver in the process, especially around maybe collage and how that would come together. So, digital has always been part of the process for you?
Oh, it was about 2001 I bought a computer.
Yeah. Because Adobe Photoshop, relatively new thing then, right? I'm assuming you were playing around with that for the collage works.
Yeah. Had a lot of visual power. I mean, I saw the designers, you know, advertising billboards and stuff on a bus stop or something, and the way they could manipulate and work with imagery and colour and composition really efficiently and quickly. And I thought, oh, I want that power.
Mm. Well, look, maybe a good reference actually to speak to is a work which I think the Auckland Art Gallery, Te Ao Tāmaki, have in their collection, a work called Parkscape from 2003.
Yeah.
In fact, Parkscape 12, again, there'll be an image of on the Good Oil Andrew McLeod Instagram post. So for a start, actually, if you could talk through that work, because looking at it, I'm not sure what of it is photography in collage and what of it is painting. So how does that work evolve and how does it inform practice?
Yeah, I guess I was a few years into using a computer by then. And so the digital, the using a computer and graphics tablets and graphics software was mainly towards making paintings. So composing and, say, drawing, and, you know, collage, digital, and digital photography coming in, all coming into the computer. And then there'd be prints. So painters have always had a thing where they make prints. It's kind of a traditional kind of thing for painters to do. And so all my printmaking, I just thought of it as I'm just a modern painter, contemporary painter, doing a bit of printmaking on the side, basically.
And digital, a natural part of that process.
Yeah, and it's definitely part of the time. I mean, I think the work is really part of its time. I don't make digital prints now because I think I'm done.
Yeah. So then for you, the use of digital has just been a no-brainer. It's you've been totally native to it from really early in the practice.
To a practitioner, it's not surprising. It's not an aberration. You look at Caravaggio or Rembrandt, and they had sets and models and lighting and drawings, and the word cartoon is putting paper on top of a surface and making an impression through the paper with, you know, to make dotted lines through the charcoal through the, you know, you have people that do something and they have their work life and it's a whole world. And then someone who doesn't know about any job, a plumber, you'll be like, oh, plumbers, a person who's not a plumber thinks a plumber does all these things, and they don't. And they think in this other way. It's not, and it's normal.
Yeah.
So, you know, no, yeah, using lighting, and it's not, it's only, it's interesting, it's that point. You know, everyone's job has things that outsiders just don't know.
Yeah.
And you forget, when you're just doing your job, you forget what's interesting or not. So, yeah, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's not, it's the same, you know, it's like, if I don't know about light, then I'm not, I would be embarrassed if Caravaggio saw my work. And Caravaggio was going before computers. You know.
Well, the other piece that I'm really interested in with you working from a digital image, so again, in your studio, you are, like, as we talk...
Oh, yeah.
...pulling, a digital image, turning it into a painting. How tricky is it for you in terms of managing light and transfer of image from digital into paint onto the support?
I mean, it's just the same as Rembrandt standing there with some model dressed up and something he bought with a light that he modified in his house, you know.
But you must find a difference between the two, a slight difference. Like you don't end up with exactly the image that you're working from a digital point of view.
When Rembrandt's setting up his set, I mean, he'll have someone wearing like a amazing fur coat, so that he can translate that into paint. So he's thinking right down the end of the line. Everything is driven towards making a painted object, a painting. Yeah, Rembrandt's choosing that textile so he can do that sort of paintwork that will go with this particular model's skin or hair. Everything is driven in the painter's mind towards the end product.
But do you feel like you lose or gain or both in that process of transfer?
It's just another one of those elusive dances that you have to do. You know, it's kind of, it's just like your limitations. There's always limitations, but it's always infinite. You know, it's like there's only so many keys on a keyboard, on a piano, but, you know, there's only so many letters in the alphabet. This book is made of letters. only letters.
Well, let me phrase that a different way. Are you ever frustrated with what can end up on the canvas from what you've created digitally?
Oh, man. I mean, you know, if you're not a perfectionist, perfectionism is part of a practitioner's world.
You're a perfectionist?
Yeah, we are. I mean, you know, I've got to do a survey in a few years at the Sargent. I'm so grateful, but also I don't want to look at my old work. It's, people don't understand. It's horrific.
Is that going to be
horrific, just looking at it? It's just too much. If you don't have that attitude, you're not doing it right. If you're not putting everything into your work. And one of the things people need to know about appreciation in the arts is, have you heard of Sturgeon's Law?
No.
It's really important. It's 90% of everything is crap. Regardless of genre,
are you worried
status.
About
status? So most painters, most practitioners are not good. If you go to a great museum in the world somewhere, not all the work is good. So I went to the National Gallery recently. I saw a Caravaggio's fucking incredible, just beyond, you know, it's magic. We're all trying to do magic, create magic. Next painting, nothing. Same artist. I should be trying to do something really good. I mean, I'm not here to, I feel responsibility and also ego. I mean, you know,
a responsibility,
I mean, that's the nature
to,
of it.
Do you feel a responsibility to yourself or to painting as a whole?
The audience, even society, if that's too much of a hope. I want everyone to like painting and I would like them to like my contribution. I mean, the chances are that I will fail because most people fail, you know. I mean,
you're not exactly failing at the moment, Andrew.
Well, you know, I mean, my work might add up to be nothing in the greater scheme of things. That's the nature of it. I mean, why do we get out of bed in the morning? Why does anyone do it? Anything? I guess I'm in the arts, and so it's not like an essential service. I'm not like what my parent, you know, my mother was a nurse, my father was a builder. I mean, that's important.
Mm.
Those are important jobs, but...
Do you think it's harder for people to see how painting is important?
Yeah, surely, and it should be. It should be harder. Yeah. Didn't we learn that from COVID? How the essential service workers were still going and sacrificing themselves when everyone else was hiding all that stuff? You know, cleaners and doctors and food supply workers and stuff, right? And, but I definitely believe that the arts do something and are important, but I can't tell you how.
It sounds like in all of that, any retrospective. So there's a retrospective at the Sargent in, well, a few years' time.
Yeah.
It sounds like that's going to be difficult for you to encounter.
Yeah, it's going to. I'm going to have to manage it emotionally. So yeah.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. I've got some strategies. Am I?
Everyone else is going to be going and seeing these extraordinary Andrew McCart paintings.
Yeah. I mean, I see what they could have been.
Mm.
You do what they, you know, you have your dream for the work, you try and get there, and sometimes you get somewhere else, and that's really good. You always get somewhere else, but it's always a balance between the two. Yeah, I mean, I work with really great art dealers, and they do a lot of the forward-facing things for me, and I help make their gallery a cool thing, and so it's definitely, it's not just me. So I can let them, if I can do most of the work, actually, for stuff like that. I mean, there's a curator as well here at the Sargent Gallery. He'll be working on it. And so it can be pretty fraught. I mean, you know, when someone writes a biography about you, I mean, imagine how weird that would be.
Well, I hate to tell you, but it's probably going to happen to you at some point.
I don't know.
Well,
I'll probably be dead.
Like getting somewhere unintended, yeah. You've touched on process again,
yeah.
And a few questions I wanted to ask around that. So in terms of deciding what goes into work, well, there's a really good line that I discovered researching for this conversation from Hamish Coney that said your paintings are, and I quote Hamish, a pub quiz of painting, referring presumably to so many references, especially art history. So in that process, how are you determining what goes into a work?
Ah, yes, but remember what we were talking about before with, say, Gordon Walters and, say, then Richard Colleen. Richard Colleen could see Gordon Walters looking at a Bellini. You know, or some of the Renaissance amazingly formal, you know, artwork. So it's they're all pub quizzes.
Yeah.
All good artwork is a pub quiz for, I mean, that's how all the other painters think about other painters. That's only someone like Hamish Coney who would think that, you know, because he has to have something to say because, you know, he's a talker and a writer, and that's awesome.
It's a good line.
And he's great to talk to, but they're just different worlds. Well, and my world is the world of a person that has a brush to canvas.
Well,
and that's why strength. So that's what I'm trying to keep on. You know, I know that I'm not an advocate or an art historian or a popularizer. So, and that's interesting. I'm trying to remember that I'm a mere practitioner. And it's a different world.
I thought to help answer that question, we might talk about a specific work from 2024. So, your show with Ivan Anthony in 2024, called Clear and Giotto.
Oh yeah.
So, I thought it'd be interesting for you to unpack what went into that work in terms of the subject matter or subjects and the process of choosing, for example, the historical characters and other elements that went into that work.
Yeah, well, it's a kind of, I put Giotto in the title. I know it sort of goes back to that thing of I'm just a sort of someone of my generation, so quotation and collage is sort of seems to be something of my generation.
So you still consider these paintings?
Of my generation.
You still consider these paintings quite collage in nature?
Yeah, but it's also, you know, it's the same with, say, when you look at a Turner, you see Claude Lorrain and Salvatore Rosa, and you see they're all. It's not different. It's just not different. It's not that different. And so, you know,
your process isn't that different.
You know, if you look at any great I would say you look at any great painting at any time and there's, you see all the influences in it, and that's just a natural thing that I think other painters do. But yeah, yeah, I mean, it is remarkable. It is a kind of, it is a thing. I can see how that's a thing, but it's not really a thing from the insider perspective of me and other painters in a way. But yeah, I mean, it might be something that my dealers say as a positive to sell to someone, but yeah, it's just a different world. And but so yeah.
Well, I wondered if
so. Yeah,
I was also wondering whether, for you, as a painting fanboy, whether you're actually presenting to us these like visual mixtapes, you know, in the same way that we made mixtapes because we were passionate about bands.
Yeah,
is that what you're doing with these works in terms of presenting different elements, different subjects? Are they visual mixtapes in a way?
Everything is. It always was. A Turner is. A Rembrandt is. Rembrandt loved Rubens. You can see it. But he was different. He's a different country, different time. But it's all in there. So it's not new. It's not. But yeah.
But for you, in terms of specific subjects and who you choose to put in a work.
Yeah. I guess it's a bit more explicit. But it's kind of, the explicit things are there. This, everything works without anything being said in a painting. As beings, we're incredibly visually knowledgeable animals. So we know so much more than we know that we know. And it's my job to work in that world. If you go and look at a painting and you have some sentences going through your head, you're not quite doing the right thing. Don't read the wall text. Just the best education is going to a big gallery somewhere in the world. Go to the National Gallery in London. Go to the Prado. Do that, and then look at some art anywhere in the world. And you don't need to read anything or say anything. I mean, it's great. I love art, you know, art history, and I read, listen to audiobooks about painters, and you know, so. So yeah, I mean, I guess you do. I put things forward. A piece of art is an arrangement of attention. A musical composition is an arrangement of attention. It does it in that way with time. A painting goes on a wall and it's an arrangement of attention. You can put things, you don't have time, so one thing doesn't literally happen after another, but you can push things forward in terms of subject matter, colour, layering, composition, brush stroke, or you can. And that's the first thing you get. The person is going to notice. But it all happens in real. Happens in real life. You can't look at a photograph of a painting and think you've seen the painting. When I travel and look at a paint, so I travelled recently and I reassessed a whole bunch of ideas I had about old master paintings because I was seeing them again in real life. So painting doesn't work in a photo. You haven't seen the painting if you've seen a photograph of a painting. That's a really important thing for appreciation. And it really happens. Composition, paintwork and scale happens at a certain size and physicality in a room when you're in the room with it. That's the art form. That's the difference between, say, illustration and comics and stuff, you know, animation. It's meant to be reproduced. It's a different strength and weakness and limitation or not limitation. So it has to happen in the room. With the actual object. And so you walk into the room and some things occur to you first and then other things, things like the scale and the colour, and especially if there's a figure in it, if there's a cat in the painting, you'll notice that really quickly. But, you know, if there's a bucket in the foreground,
which sometimes there are in your works,
you won't notice it. Because you're not trained to think about buckets in your daily life.
Well, to go back,
you know,
to
what
that.
I mean. So it's all in a, it's just subject matter is part of the arrangement of attention, and it's a whole thing. It's subject matter and composition and paintwork. You know, writers talk about style, and is it about style or is it in composition or is it about what they're writing about? The subject matter is like, it's a really difficult thing to unpack. Yeah.
To quote back to you then, a painting is an arrangement of attention, which is like articulates so efficiently and beautifully, you know, what painting is. So for you, how do you approach that composition piece? And is that back to process of that digital creation?
Well, generally, sort of physically at the moment, I generally start with a little drawing, small drawing, graphite drawing, really small. Work out a dream for a painting from that.
A dream for a painting?
Yeah. Yeah. You can achieve a lot really small. It's quite efficient.
And what's really small? 10 by 10 centimetres by 10 centimetres?
Totally. Yeah. 100 by, smaller, half that. I'll do a lot and have done a lot, yeah. And often I had a drawing of a room, and then I would draw the painting on the wall of the room, so I get the scale, and then I could think about the scale and the composition together right from the beginning, which is an interesting novel thing. Then I'd roughly get a big room and put some lights, flash, lighting modifiers, camera, wireless triggers.
Yeah, because there's
lighting stands.
Standing in your studio with you, like there is, I don't know how many different cameras and lenses behind me.
Yeah.
These are all part of process.
Yeah, yeah. I think the whole technical thing, I think, computers and graphics gear and photography gear, I think we need to, painters need to not be lazy about that stuff. You learn to photograph your own paintings. It's not a crutch.
So where does photography fit into subject matter for you in terms of that transition from presumably photographing something to a digital composition?
Yeah, everything goes into the computer, including the drawing.
Yeah.
So often I'd open the drawing and then sort of make it transparent, apart from, say, black lines or white lines, and then I'd photograph stuff and figures and from the drawing, with the drawing in front of me. But everything has to be taken apart. So every figure has to be taken apart, cut up, and stuck back together. So everything, because I'm trying to get the logic of space and composition that comes from painting.
Is that more difficult to do on an entirely flat surface that is digital? Or am I misunderstanding the process?
Oh, well, you're always dreaming about the final product, which is the painting. It's like the way, Rembrandt would choose a particular textile so he could paint it with a certain type of paintwork that he's already thinking about as soon as he bought the textile for too much money, and bankrupted himself.
So you're looking at your digital composition, but seeing it in paint.
Yeah, thinking what sort of really great paintwork I could do, or, it's like kind of like a certain type of lighting. I'm trying to get to Caravaggio with that Southern European harder light, less diffused light and harder, but it sort of doesn't really feel natural because, I live in New Zealand, so it's a bit more diffuse, It's kind of like, I'm not a Southern European Italian, so it's a bit more Rembrandt lighting, seems a bit more sort of natural.
So you're managing light for a painting in a digital composition before you're anywhere near painting it?
Yeah, at the moment, yeah, yeah. I mean, that's just another thing. I mean, I'd like to do everything. I'd like to have another lifetime and just be an abstract painter. I'd like to have another lifetime, but, what am I going to do?
Yeah, at the moment you're trying to...
I mean, I'm not very healthy. I'm not going to live forever, so that's limitation. The main limiting factor is one lifetime.
Yeah.
And we're talking about these art forms, and they're cumulative. I mean, people are influenced by other people down the generations, and then there's so many more painters before you, and you have to take all that in. I mean, we are living a bit longer, I guess.
Well, that approach to composition and managing light and colour, does that allow you to create what I think is one of the strongest features of your work, which is a sense of almost perfect depth for all the subjects and subject material sitting against a background?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're always also flat. I mean, I love that play in painting history. It's kind of like from Gustave Courbet on, it's kind of like they started flattening shit out again. I mean, because photography was there, so it's like, oh, well, that does that. And then they went back. That's the whole pre-Raphaelite thing. So, like, oh, I've got this. They have this used this weird space and before Raphael. And I mean, that's creating a space is a fucking interesting and amazing thing that painting can do, especially at scale. So all those weird spaces, unnatural spaces, they all work. They're meant to go at a certain scale of the painting. But I mean, photography is weird as well. that has its own weird space as well. I mean, look at focal length. I mean, this simple thing. Some lenses are very wide, some lenses are very, very far in the distance, and that's incredibly significant. And this is all the same sort of shit that painters should play with, right?
Well, is that depth then that you're creating on what is, you know, ultimately a flat surface, obviously, that's presumably then really critical for you to be able to include as much detail and as many subjects as you do?
Oh, yeah, compositionally, what I'm picking up from that question is a question of tempo.
Mm.
So I have very fast tempo paintings, and so the modernists, some of them, like, or some of the minimalists, sort of liked slow tempo paintings. And
terms of how viewers consume them.
It's an analogy or metaphor or something. It doesn't matter.
Because there is a huge amount of information in your paintings.
Yeah. I mean, a really fantastic composition. Oh, you know, Mondrian's pretty fast. What's a slow tempo great paint? I don't know, some Walters.
Oh, you mentioned
It's not about... Tempo is independent of complexity. You know, so in music, if you have a really slow piece, it can still be incredibly complex. So people often make the assumption that something, if it's fast, it must be more complex, but it's not like that. They're independent. So.
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, a really great low tempo. Some of the Caravaggios have all this black in the shadows, this huge amount of black. That's like a slow tempo thing, and they're fucking amazing.
Well, we were talking about Van der Velden earlier as well, before we started recording, and I suppose the same with his work. There's a lot of dark fields in his work.
Yeah, but his much more brushwork in those darks than in a... Yeah, there's still brushwork. It's a different type of brushwork. It's just sort of less thick, or impasto, they call it. That's really important stuff to notice. You should always look at things like that. Is the paint thin or thick or tactile? Or because that's half the fucking art form. So, yeah, when you go to a great museum somewhere in the world, always go up close to the painting and feel those things, because the painter was doing something for you to appreciate.
Well, that's something else that I think, right? looking at your work, I have a sense that transparency is something, especially with oil paint, that's something that you consider really, really carefully, especially because of how much information, how many subjects are in these works that you've been making for the last 10 years. So is transparency something that you consider maybe alongside tempo as well?
Oh, yeah, it's all of it. I mean, it's layers. Yeah, the human eye can perceive if it's a transparent yellow over a opaque blue or vice versa. Those are stuff you can see, and this is why painting is so fantastic, because it's so articulate in all this stuff, and you don't get in there in a photo. It should be it's one of the most important things. Like that are some of the first things that I look at in a painting, and everyone should. And I think we have kind of, I don't know, people look at the wall text or the price list first, you know, and it's just weird habits that people get into in appreciation, and they can often be wrong. But people like me forget to tell everyone what to look at, or it's not my job.
Yeah.
I mean, I've got a bit, it's a big of enough job trying to make something good, and I'll probably fail. And so trying to tell people how to look at them, it needs to be done, but
I suppose alongside transparency is colour.
Yeah. So they go together. Yeah, alongside. Yeah.
So and really want to talk about your colour management as well, because they've become, you know, these incredibly obviously visually rich, but you seem to be working with these really rich velvety reds that, from, you know, a colour point of view, have almost come to define the work in the last, you know, 10 years or so. So I guess for a start, why is red so often the dominant colour in work?
Oh, well, there's some lovely new reds invented in the last 30 years, the pyrroles and stuff. They're more transparent and less muddy than cadmiums. They're pretty amazing. So I've been... yeah, getting really into that.
So it's actually not symbolism. It is. It's just like, wow, there's this great new material, this great new red that I can play with.
Yeah, I mean, why did Francis Bacon use so much of the orange? I mean, yeah, I mean, he's a pretty huge influence. I mean, he just, it was just sort of available to him in his world. I mean, I see the red thing goes back to, I mean, it's fucking red blankets in Caravaggio. And then you see it all went into film with Derek Jarman and Greenway. So a lot of, and then it's come back out into painting, people like me. Not that I'm part of, you know, I live in New Zealand, so.
Well, they can come
I'm not part of, but I saw that stuff, that those filmmakers and those painters. So, you know, I mean, the red blanket is just like.
Because they come across as a stage set almost in your paintings. They feel like a this rich velvet backdrop.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the whole theatre and painting connection is much bigger and deeper. I mean, you look at Giotto, they're all sets, you know, they're. The early Renaissance stuff is their sets, you know. I mean, I'm learning more about that now, especially trying to direct models and stuff now.
Which you were doing in the photography process?
Yeah, yeah. And that's, oh gosh, this is like theatre and film or something. It's like, oh. It's all very artful as well. And, yeah, it's all another, it's, yeah.
It's funny, it sounds like you're realising you're director as much as painter.
Yeah, but it's the same. I mean, you know, I guess painters, we like to think that we're not part of showbiz, but we are.
Or more on colour. So yeah. A couple more questions I want to ask about that.
Yeah.
With your works, again, especially the works from the last 10 years,
yeah,
sumptuous, lavish are words that come to mind, especially with, like, basically all of the tones of the colour that you're using, like the purples. In fact, there's purple in this work that you're working on at the moment. Against like some pretty lavish red as well.
Yeah.
Are lavish and sumptuous the feelings that you're wanting to evoke either with yourself or viewer of those works?
Yeah, well, that's kind of, those words kind of go with theatre and things like luxury, fashion. I mean, it's not, you know, it's kind of like I don't think my generation is afraid of fashion or textile history and things like that. I think anyone older is kind of insecure. But I just look at everything, anything good. And you talk about Francis Bacon, you know, it's kind of like, that pink was luxury. All those things, I mean, you know, I mean, excess, restraint, I mean, it's all just emotional, it's all analogies to life and emotions and ecstasy, despair, you know, I mean, it's life. It's meant to be about life. I'm meant to say something about life, and we all have an emotional life.
Well, you're also.
I mean, so they're tools to talk about life. Harmony and dissonance, you know, beautiful, ugly. It's all in there in any good work. It's a combination, complex, coherent combination of
including
both
your
things.
Work.
Not equal. It can be more harmonious or less, or more dissonant or less. Yeah. But there's nothing new in luxury or excess. But, you know, we're a sort of Protestant, English, Scottish, Welsh, kind of Irish, you know, kind of background. So we're probably a bit Puritan, you know. And it's tough for a visual culture person to be in a Puritan society. I mean, it always happens. I don't think people just younger care.
Well, the other element that I wanted to ask about, because especially we're looking at a close-up in the digital image that you are, as I say, painting right now.
Yeah.
It looks like you also really enjoy painting textiles. Like, I'm looking at what is like a velvety-looking blanket robe.
Yeah.
So with textiles really central to work as well. It feels like they often are.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's funny. I find them kind of easy. But, you know, Liz Moore, the great Liz Moore, painter, figurative painter, she finds it really difficult. She's like, I hate doing textiles. She likes doing the actual portrait. She's like,
yeah.
I don't enjoy painting portraits. It's like hell. It's kind of, you know, it's really great and interesting, but it's like, it's funny what different people sort of find easy or enjoy.
Yeah. So textiles is something you really enjoy. I mean, looking at this, this is gorgeous.
Comparatively, yeah, it's not about enjoyment. I enjoy the having finished the thing, and I never want to see it again. So, yeah, I mean, it's
heaven forbid a retrospective.
For a professional, it's not about enjoyment.
Mm. You just also touched on portrait painting.
Yeah.
There are figures in your works or subjects in your work that are really close to you. So Claire, your partner, appears in works quite often. But then there's also these historical figures that you've obviously never known, certainly never sat for you.
Yeah.
So how do you balance painting those different figures? Like, you obviously don't need to know someone necessarily to be able to paint them. Or do subjects that you know personally end up feeling different for you painting them?
It's all a setup. So I think sometimes I say I do ensemble pieces. I think it's a theatre thing or a film thing where there's no one lead character.
Not ensemble, collage.
Huh, yeah, there we go. Yeah, it's that sort of ambivalence about who's, there's no, yeah, that sort of play. So there's, sometimes I do one portrait in a painting. But yeah, I kind of like the people that work off each other, you know. It's a setup. It's like, you know, that happens, that's character. And, you know, novelists set up their characters.
So as you say, it's ensemble more than portrait.
Yeah, like I painted a figure from my Rembrandt recently, my last show, and there was five other figures in the same painting. And they were all contemporaries, just people from around Whanganui. Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, the people notice who was the sitter somewhat as part of painting appreciation. It's interesting to know, oh, this is their partner, or this is a signifier for a culture. I mean, Auckland is pretty amazing for faces and people. I mean, isn't it, with those incredibly... where I spent most of my life.
So are you always looking for interesting subjects then for the ensemble?
Yeah, yeah.
Whether they are art history figures or whether they are partners or people on the street in Auckland or...
Yeah, yeah. Ultimately, I'm trying to make a painting rather than think about a person. So it's more of a poem than a biography. I mean, painting my partner... Claire, she's kind of like half English. She's got this kind of real subtle different look. And this, so when I paint her, it's, oh, this fits into English art history much more. It's kind of... so I've been wanting to do a painting with two English people or something, you know. And it's like, oh, this is an English painting now. and it's just an observation I made.
It's almost like you're saying...
It's incredibly subtle, I mean, yeah.
It's almost like you're saying Claire fits into pre-Raphaelite paintings easier maybe than some other subjects.
She's got other stuff going on, yes. I mean, yeah, there's a bit of American in there, sort of modernist American in there too somehow. Genetically as well with her. The Paraphilite thing is I have approached that with different figures. Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's a classic kind of Reed Hair thing, which is kind of about colour, which I've done. But yeah, the Pre-Raphaelite thing is, I mean, I'm not, I don't like the Pre-Raphaelites more as a period than any other, in any historical period, there are really great people. So in every period has something, yeah, really great.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I've sort of got this, it's kind of just hammy theatrical. It's something for the dealers to tell people, oh, yeah. Pre-Raphaelite. It's not really, and it's kind of accidental. And also, I'm honestly attracted to things that everyone thinks is really uncool in the art world, unfortunately.
Because you're
so that's the point.
Because you're painting these really old Renaissance, yeah, pre-Raphaelite, whatever convenient label works for them.
Yeah.
You mean that is a bit uncool?
Fuck yeah. I mean, the whole 19th century is incredibly uncool. But it's incredibly interesting because I never saw it much when I was younger as an art painter, and now suddenly the internet comes along, you can see more of the 19th century painting. Yeah, I don't know, it's really interesting to see new things. I mean, it's kind of the great thing about, I saw the big show at the Tate recently of female artists in Britain. Some of those people are fairly new discoveries. I mean, I only got into Gwyn John, the great Welsh painter, who's incredibly important to everyone who's seen her now. And that's only happened in the last 20 years. And we couldn't see her work before that because she was a woman. No one will ever see our work in New Zealand for a very long time. I think New Zealanders, there's no hope, very little hope for international. No one wants to look at New Zealand.
We are a bit of a backwater for tours.
It kind of gives you a freedom as well. And this extra freedom I have, I can ham up some Paraphilite reference because it doesn't matter, no one cares.
Yeah.
I'm in New Zealand.
Yeah.
I mean, New Zealanders sort of care. Yeah, I mean, art is sort of nationalistic in that people like to buy work from their own country, which is really good. Otherwise, they'd just buy another Damien Hirst.
Mm. But the nice thing about your work is that I see New Zealand in your work. They might seem like art history paintings, but I see New Zealand fences and I see New Zealand flora.
Yeah, the whole garden thing is really... Flora is really apparent in my work. Yeah.
So why is that? Yeah. Why does flora get a front row seat often in the works?
Oh, I think my parents were great gardeners in Auckland, which grows amazingly with the climate and soil. And so, yeah.
So are we looking at often roses, irises?
Yeah, I don't know the names of flowers. I just know what they look like very much. I ring my mum sometimes for titles. What's this flower in this painting? And she tells me what it is so I can put it in the title.
But is that where they're coming from? Are lots of the flora references from your parents' garden?
Yeah, totally. My folks were competitive dahlia growers. Pretty incredible. Had amazing gardens. So that's pretty formative.
Last question that I ask everyone, Andrew. If we were removing any limit of budget or whether a work is held in a public institution, what work or artist work in general would you love to live with?
I've got a two options at the top of my... that occur to me. I guess a more interesting one is Giotto at Assisi, the Giotto cycle at the Assisi Chapel. I haven't seen it for a long time, 20 years. But yeah, it's better than the Arena Chapel, that's true. And he's sort of the beginning of something, Giotto, with regard to the art form that I still practice. Yeah, I mean, it's fresco, and it's larger, it's late. Yeah, I mean, I'm not alone in putting Giotto at the beginning of the tradition. This more specific tradition, I guess. It's beautiful that we still have the hand of the artist, the brushwork and the layering, the sensibility, the touch of a person from a master from a long time ago, someone who was really dedicated and complex practitioner. And so we don't have that in music. We don't have the hand of Mozart on the keyboard. We don't have this lost. But in painting, we have that.
As always, thank you for listening. Your next chance to see new work from Andrew will be at the Aotearoa Art Fair held at the Viaduct Events Centre between the 1st and 4th of May. You can find his work at the Robert Held Gallery booth. Otherwise, contact Ivan Anthony Gallery in Tamaki Makaurau, Auckland, or Robert Held Gallery in Wellington, Te Whanganui Atara, for available works. Please join me for episode 32 of The Good Oil. Until then, ka kite anō.